Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Well, today, it's the 15th of April, 2012. And unless you've been vacationing on Mars for the last few weeks, you know that 100 years ago, at 12:37 Eastern Time, the world's greatest superliner, the Titanic, sank. And it has me thinking about the changes over the last 100 years from 1912 to 2012. Just for one moment, I want to talk about the progressive sentiment of the early 20th century. Items of interest to architects and to those of us also very vitally involved today, 100 years or so later, in the good green, good food movements. In 1906, there was the passage of the Pure Food Act, which was very important because up until that time, for several decades, prepared and processed foods had had patent medicines mixed in with them. Sounds a lot like genetically modified content, doesn't it? So there are patent medicines that were in all sorts of prepared foods. Dr. Wayne's Hair Restorer, a special breakfast for dads, and all sorts of other nonsense like that. Well, that was made absolutely illegal with the 1906 Pure Food Act towards the end of the presidency of arguably our most progressive president, Theodore Roosevelt. Roll ahead, 1912. There was building, starting in the 1860s, this awareness that cities needed more green space. And to that end, our guest is Kate Bakewell. I think I hear you in the background there.
Hello, Curtis.
Hi, I'm here. How are you?
Fine. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely. 5x5. Thank you. So a lot has happened in the last 100 years, and it seems to me, trying to put some sort of historical lens or filter on this, that a lot of the progressive ideas of the early 20th century took 100 years to really gain some currency, especially as pertains to what we would say now, the greening of the city. So, Kate, there are a few things that I would like to speak with you this afternoon. Kate Bakewell is a landscape architect, and she is the founder of a foundation. Are you a foundation? BioCities. Tell us a little bit about BioCities, just off the top.
Okay, BioCities is a nonprofit organization founded just really in late 2011, so we're very new. The idea behind our group is to find ways to advocate for and activate functional ecosystems in cities, so real ecosystems that really do something productive in service of making cities more livable. And we're kind of trying to fight against this notion that any bit of green is good enough, so that a piece of lawn is an ecosystem. Well, it's not really as functional and as useful as, say, a wetland. So we're just a voice for bringing more of nature into a city in a way that is productive and is maybe going to help us reverse some of the degradation that we see in our on our planet, in our cities, and find a way to make cities more livable because they are growing.
Sure. Well, there are lots of different little threads that we can follow, and I hope to get to many of them. Mm-hmm. I just want to lay out a few, and then we'll take a little break. You can frame your thoughts, and we can dive in. The city of New York specifically has come out in favor. They're encouraging this new kind of development of the land, a thing called a bioswale. We could talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We all know, all of us who live in New York, that when there are heavy storms, and increasingly, whether you believe in global warming or not, we have had storms of unprecedented or unexpected severity. And when it rains a lot in New York, because we have combined sewers, which means that many of the sewer pipes down there under the ground carry both sewage and stormwater, that the sewage then flows out into the rivers in the bay, and that is a very bad thing. I believe that some of the work that BioCities intends to do will help mitigate that condition. Also, in the last 100 years, we've gone through the cycle of the experiment of the automobile. 100 years ago, there was the city, and then there were farm territories surrounding the cities, and produce came into the city by train. Well-documented, concerted efforts of automotive industry and also the tire, like Goodyear, industries together have killed off a lot of the regional transit. They've killed off the trolleys. Many, many, many of us have chosen to move into the cities and leave the suburbs. The experiment with the automobile seems to be fading. But what's happened now is that the farms are being moved into the city. People here, as a part of the Roberta's Restaurant and Heritage Foods world, who are then our sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network, are, you know, some of the key players, starting with the Brooklyn Grange and other urban farming initiatives, which are not just here but everywhere in Boston and in other cities, bringing the farms into the city. And this is a very exciting new development to me. And it's a continuation of the progressive spirit that suggests that big changes could be made in the way that corporate America is held accountable, which kind of died out when TR was not elected in 1912, and the pro-business Republicans were elected with Taft. But I don't want to get too much into politics. I want to talk about all of these initiatives and your thoughts on them, how urban designing now is more landscape-oriented, and you and your profession of landscape architects have acceded to a primary role in terms of urban design and urban planning. So let's just take a little break and come back and dive in. Burning Down the House, I'm Curtis B. Wayne, talking with you on the 100th commemoration of the sinking of the Titanic, talking about changes over the last 100 years, especially in terms of reintroducing the natural ecology into our cityscape with Kate Bakewell, landscape architect. Now it's your turn to talk.
Well, one thing that passed through my mind when you were speaking about the Titanic, which you didn't really hit upon, but maybe is another thread here, is the confrontation of a major technological force with a major or several major natural forces. And that's just, I think, another sort of, I don't know, idea that's part of something we're all grappling with as designers, just how to understand natural forces in a different way so that we use them more intelligently.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. It was an actual collision between the hubris of technology and the irresistible force of nature. The unsinkable ship hit an iceberg that wasn't going to move. And in the later 20th century, technology failed us, and we had largely ruined our environment.
And it just, you know, it highlights what we know, but we seem to keep trying to avoid recognizing is that technology isn't the panacea for our problems. And so it is heartening to see things like bioswales introduced into cities. But I'd like to see those kinds of movements progress even further by a lot more depth in terms of researching how they work and how to make them better. And I think there's still a real lack of understanding about how biological systems work. And we tend to want to lean on technological systems, which will always fail us in some way or another. We'll always improve them, but I think that there's something much more intelligent about biological systems that we have yet to really tap into as strongly as we could.
Yeah, Kate, for the benefit of our civilian listeners, of whom there are many, could you describe for us, in your landscape architect kind of way, what is a bioswale? How does it work, and why is it good?
Okay, a bioswale is it's an absorptive surface that is designed to collect stormwater runoff, and they're typically, you know, soils and plants, and if they're done right, they will absorb quite a bit of stormwater and bring it down into the water table, as well as filter the water and make it more pure. It is really important to a city like New York because, as you were talking about before, there's a lot of runoff that hits the water treatment plant and overwhelms the system and then gets released along with the raw sewage into the open bodies of water. So bioswale, if we can create more absorptive surfaces like bioswales to intervene and capture that water before it goes into the catch basins, then we're taking the burden off of the water treatment system and thereby reducing, if not maybe one day eliminating, the combined sewer overflows that are a huge problem at the moment.
Good, thank you. Well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. A lot of people who visit New York see the tall buildings, and they are told that the reason that we have the tall buildings in New York is because we've got underneath Manhattan Island, we've got bedrock, we've got Manhattan granitic schist. I almost mispronounced that in a German way, which would be very embarrassing. But anyway, schist, and... But that is not so. In your work, and I know in the work of others such as Terrapin Bright Green, with whom I work from time to time, we use as a reference this wonderful project called Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what you understand about the Manhattan Project.
Ooh, I do have the book, and I haven't read it. It's a very thick book, but it's a documentation of the Manhattan prior to the European settlement, and it illuminates that there are many, many ecosystems that were in place, many very different ones, and it was a rich tapestry of ecosystems that were here in the city, lots of little streams and, you know, incredible topography. and that there's still remnants of that throughout the city that you can find and that you can sort of re-expose, reveal, and maybe bring back into some modern version of what they used to be. But it's a really fascinating study of the natural history of the island of Manhattan. And there are beautiful illustrations in there too, and it's a very evocative book.
And it's a good resource. Speaking as an architect, it's a terrific resource that I wish that we would have had a few years before it was published, because as we dig down to put in the foundations for new buildings, we discover the natural geology, which includes watercourses that have been buried, and sometimes we have huge surprises, like driving piles through ancient stream beds that are full of water some times of the year, which if you're putting in your foundations the wrong way could cause a great deal of damage. Or, in other cases, certain community parks or shall we say community gardens that have popped up in vacant lots, people are discovering after the fact that these gardens did very well because the vacant land was originally a wetland and there is natural water under the surface. That if you look at the city and you just take that as a given, you think that because it's all paved, it must just be all impermeable down as far as you would dig. But in fact, there are many different soil conditions under the hardscape of the city, which has been built up over the centuries to blot out nature to a great deal. And it's been very successful at that. And so what I'm understanding that bioswales and then the work that your organization is hoping to do will allow the natural geology to start to function in the way that nature intended, as a balance to in part let rainwater get into the aquifer.
Well, and for us to find a way to work more cooperatively with these systems. What's great about the city introducing bioswales and a lot of the thinking that goes along with so many different new design initiatives is that there's this recognition that nature really does have a place in cities, and it really can be a formidable element in the design of cities. And we're changing our attitudes. I've seen even in the past 10 years this tremendous change in attitude and this recognition of welcoming nature in cities in many different ways, in some kind of newly manipulated way, or maybe just trying to restore it to what it used to be, or the whole spectrum of different ways of handling nature. But there's this real eagerness to understand that better. And what I've been finding is that there is still so much we don't know about how wild ecosystems work, and especially how they might work in cities. And so I firmly believe that we need to have thousands of experiments that try to understand this better and observe them closely, measure them, and use this knowledge that we gain to do them better. So we need to do a lot of that, and very rapidly.
Well, as I understand, sometimes natural forces simply just pop up from something that I read about an experimental or demonstration farm at Battery Park, which of course is the original site of the New Amsterdam settlement, that there's a wild turkey in residence running around the park. I believe her name is Gertrude. No, actually, I believe that's what they call her. But who would imagine that a wild turkey would somehow arrive in Manhattan,
in
a parkland? She must have either come across on a Staten Island ferry. We know that there are a lot of wild turkeys in Staten Island, really big ones, big scary ones. I used to have to, for a project, go out to Staten Island University Hospital. You take the SIRT line, the above ground rail system in Staten Island, get off and walk several blocks, and out there, it's fairly suburban, one and two-story houses, lots of cars, and there are these flocks of really huge turkeys wandering through people's backyards and stopping traffic. And so one of those somehow got into Battery Park. But so do you, I'd like to frame this in terms of city planning issues. I mean, back in the middle or late 20th century, I have a received notion, and I can't really defend this, but I do have the very strong notion that green space was seen as an underutilized real estate resource.
And meaning that it's a future building lot? Is that...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I believe I do. You want to elaborate on that?
I mean, there were the spaces that were set aside in the original commissioner's plan of 1811, Union Square, Madison Square, Central Park. There were a couple of other parks that were set out in that master plan, that master map that was made, which did not come to fruition. And it was pretty much taken as a given set piece of these are the parks, and anything else that could be developed that wasn't identified as that was going to be a park, it was understood would be developed with buildings and increasingly larger buildings as the population pressure grew and more people needed more places to live. Farms gave way to houses. Houses gave way to tenements. Tenements gave way to high-rise and mid-rise development with increasingly smaller rear yards, side yards, front yards disappeared. And that the notion that there needed to be more parkland or more green space wasn't even considered.
Well, because the densities were so much less and the pressures were just not as great. I mean, you were probably surrounded by little patches of green space all over the city. And then it's
sure, accidentally, it's, just as a matter of if it was an older development style, there would have been a yard.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So there's not, you don't crave a big park because you're already kind of, there's some, you know, your needs for open space are probably sort of fulfilled to some degree or another. And then when the city got much more dense and you know, people started to appreciate Central Park and see the marvels of that, and then as the city got more and more dense, Central Park became more and more precious. It just changes the entire notion about green space being more precious as we lost it. It's just like farmland. The more we lose farmland, the more we sort of get this romantic notion about saving the farm. I mean, it's like many things having to do with nature. As we lose it, we start to wake up to the fact that we're close to losing something.
Right. Well,
altogether.
Again, using the lens of history, from my point of view, as an architect having studied urban design a little bit, although it was not my major in grad school, which I sometimes regret. I could have done the Master of Architecture in Urban Design course there at GSD, but I got in and got out, just got my plain old MArch. But I see that, you know, the battle between Jane Jacobs in the West Village and Robert Moses, the highway builder, was there in the 1950s, 1960s period, a battle between saving the street and losing the highway. Moses was this commissioner who had enormous influence, and he was responsible for the parkways in Long Island, developing Riverside Drive into a parkway, the West Side Highway, the East Side Parkway, which is now the FDR, and the Bronx River Parkway, and some of the parkways up in Westchester, then riffed on that idea. So Jane Jacobs really was a key player in trying to save the street, which meant losing the car. And now, in order to save the city, we have to lose some of the hardness of this mechanistic and overbuilt 20th century paradigm and bring the farm back into the city. Let's take a little break, think about this change in paradigm, and I'd like your thoughts on urban farming, if possible. Burning Down the House, Curtis B. Wayne speaking with Kate Bakewell. That was some very interesting 48-tone music from Harry Partch, composed about 60 years ago, which sets me thinking, wow, it's like we're moving away from this 20th century mechano sphere to more of a biosphere. Do you think that the farming in the city movement, which seems to have a huge traction suddenly here in Boston and Berkeley and to a little bit of extent in Chicago, dilutes the message? Does it subvert your efforts by focusing on something you can eat instead of something that's just good for the environment? What do you think?
No, not at all. I actually think it's the next generation of a really great way to use city space. So take rooftops, for example. I was part of I've done a number of green roofs in the city and they have their place for sure in terms of urban heat island mitigation and stormwater retention. But if you take it to a farm, if you turn these into farms, then they have yet another purpose, and they provide local food, and they provide habitat for more pollinators. They actually will probably retain more stormwater because it's a bit more soil, although that's something that's being measured, and there's some people out there who are looking into that. I think it's an exciting movement, but I also think that we need to understand it better. It can be a little bit of a fad, and there's this real interest, but we don't really have a good handle on how to do it most effectively. And I think that's sort of the next wave, is to try to understand that better. But I think that farms in general in the city have a place for more than just food. I mean, of course, there are these wonderful landscapes, but I think one of the most powerful things they can do is probably help us with our organic waste reuse. So rather than shipping our organic waste off to some far-flung state, we can keep it locally and have the advantage of all those nutrients staying right here, rebuilding our soils and going back into food systems. So I'm very excited about the urban farm movement, but I'm not seeing it happen just yet or manifested just yet in ways that are at a scale that's really meaningful. But that's probably going to take some time.
Yeah, well, being that I'm a bit of a geek, I would call that an integration of support systems. Mm-hmm. And it ain't there yet. Although there is, it seems to me that it's almost tribal. That there are like different clans working on different aspects of this. A few weeks ago, I had as our guest Didi Mauker, who's founder of Masters of Succession, and they're aggressive composters, and they're using the approach of encouraging everybody to compost their own kitchen waste using special mixture of enzymes that some Japanese scientist has discovered, that then you can take your kitchen waste to a community garden where it can supplement the soil.
That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about is and I think where we need to be headed, and we're seeing it in grassroots movements, and I think it just needs to grow and become more integral to the city's metabolism, quite frankly.
Yeah. On a side note, but to lead into the next thing that I'd like to talk about. I was thinking about this almost tribal aspect of the different groups that you encounter in a city. Yesterday was the culmination of Scottish Week in New York.
And somehow that came and went, and I didn't realize.
And I, being partially Scot, of course, had to go to the parade yesterday. But I mean, and here was a rising of the clans, and it was joyous, and it was raucous, and... And it got me thinking about all of these different degrees of separation between people I know through Heritage Radio Network and people I know through work, and how these different clans overlap. And in the next segment, I do want to talk about the upcoming symposium. Do we call it a symposium? The event that you are hosting in May.
Mm-hmm. May 2nd. Mm-hmm.
Let's have a little tribal music and come back. That was, of course, Scotland Rising, recorded on my smartphone yesterday afternoon about this time. So the tribes of Heritage Foods, Heritage Radio Network, your own tribal groups are all coming together, and you're going to talk about food systems as a placemaker, is that correct?
Kate? In a built environment, so how food shapes
cities. Oh, you dropped out for a sec. Hold on. Start again.
The effect of food systems in the built environment and how food systems shape cities, and we're trying to look at it from some specific angles, which is the ecological perspective as well as the economic perspective, which, of course, are interrelated perspectives. And probably... speaking a little bit, not so much on the health perspective or the social and community opportunities and benefits, because those seem to be covered quite adequately in a lot of the food discussions that I've been to. And I think that what is underrepresented is what it can mean, what food systems, urban agriculture can mean for the metabolism for a city, and what it might mean for the economics of the city, and how does it work economically.
Well, hold on. All of this sounds great, except you lose me. It sounds like you're reading from some sort of policy wonk paper that got put... if you could put it more plainly, let's start from the top. Your event is called what?
It's called How Food Shapes Cities... Ecological and Economic Perspectives.
Okay, and who might we expect to hear speak?
Okay, well, we have one of the sort of inspirations for all this is somebody you also know, Carolyn Steele, who wrote the book Hungry City, and she wrote a very interesting history of cities and food systems, and just demonstrating that the shape of cities is often the product of how food was brought in, distributed, manufactured, created, consumed, and disposed of.
You mean through the market? marketplace being an open public arena?
Right, the marketplace being one feature of a food system, but it's also how is food brought in? Where how were the livestock brought in? How was food processed? How was it consumed? And all these things have implications in terms of how we design the infrastructure of our cities and the buildings. And if you start to study the design of cities from this perspective that she uses from food, you just see it, and you can start to understand that things were shaped by the fact that humans have to eat.
Yeah, well, I, again, to play devil's advocate, I do know from my city planning courses that some of those food processing areas were pretty nauseating. There were slaughterhouses.
Like the stockyards in Chicago.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. But here mm-hmm. in Manhattan, there were slaughterhouses down in the, now it's the trendy meatpacking district. Well, it's called that because there were slaughterhouses down there. Mm-hmm. And there were wholesale butchers. There were slaughterhouses on the East River where the United Nations is now located, which when food processing was located out of the more dense parts of New York City to other, you know, outsourced to, you know, Armour out in Midwest for meatpacking and then brought in through refrigerated shipping.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then there used to be all these big markets in, where people would come, and I understand that some of them were 24 hours a day, and they were quite the community hubs. I'm not suggesting that we bring back stockyards or slaughterhouses, or even suggesting exactly what we bring back, but just to start to examine it and to look at how we can design our cities so that they're maybe better. That are suited to have more local, more healthy food. This has implications for not just health, but food security, and on and on and on. It's just, we're at this moment where we are all starting to think about it, and we're starting to maybe change the way we design cities around these issues, and what does that mean? So it's this symposium is really an examination and an exploration, a discussion, a debate. It's not intended to resolve anything in a single day, but what we are doing is we're capturing all of it on video, and we'll make all that information available to anyone who is interested, because we want to be this kind of place where knowledge is collected and archived and then redistributed, so we can all learn and all kind of improve.
Well, that's good. I, being a designer of physical realities and not a policy guy, always want to jump ahead to, well, these are great ideas and I'm glad that we're talking about them, what does it look like?
Right. Well, one of our speakers, and this is someone I wanted to promote in your last segment, but here's an opportunity. One of our speakers is a good colleague of mine, Alec Baxt, and he is an urban farmer, and he will be talking about how you would do a rooftop farm that is actually commercially viable. So, right now, the models we have out there are maybe not completely great commercially viable, self-sustaining systems, but he's been really studying this from a business perspective to see what it would take to make that happen in a place like New York, and he's kind of developed a model that could work, but it requires a large-scale farm. It requires something along the lines of a 3-acre rooftop, and if he can do and buy-in from the owner where they provide the roof system substrate, but with that combination, the building owner gets a lot of benefits, the city gets a lot of benefits, and two farmers get to earn a living wage farming a roof.
That's a lot of acreage in New York.
It is, but we have so many giant warehouses and large buildings that maybe not in Manhattan, but certainly in the other boroughs, and these are just, kind of underutilized surfaces at the moment.
Yeah, provided, and I don't want to be a wet blanket, but provided that the roof is structurally capable of supporting 100
exactly.
pounds a square foot,
yeah.
Which is
one of the real challenges when we've been sort of discussing this is that, please be a wet blanket, because if we if we don't want to kid ourselves about this stuff, we need to really take good hard looks at the realities and the challenges and try to tackle them and not be too romantic about it. And the loads are certainly considerable when it comes to doing a foot of soil on a roof. So
or more. I mean, a foot's just intensive planting. I mean, extensive with fruit trees means a lot more root space,
right.
A lot more medium, a lot more water being aggregated. I'm interested in what a natural or what nature's way of organizing a marketplace would be like, other than a parking lot with a lot of trucks that drove in from 50, 100, or 200 miles away. Because I think, in a way, that's a little wrong, but I would love to be part of a conversation of how we develop this into something that's a little less just stuff off the back of the truck and something that's a little more developed. Jack, could we have a minute and a half of the next song?
Just wait.
Curtis B. Wayne, Burning Down the House with Kate Bakewell. So, what would the food distribution areas look like? I hope you're going to be able to get into that when you have your event. Remind us again, when is that?
It's May 2nd, and it's happening in downtown Manhattan at 40 Broad Street from 8 to 8. So it's a long day with daytime sessions up until 5:30, cocktail reception, and then an evening panel. So
do you have to sign up for the whole day?
No, you don't. You can sign up for just the day. If you sign up for the day, that is the whole day. Or you can just elect to sign up for the evening panel if you want to just...
Do you have to show up, or are advance tickets required?
You can just go to the website, biocities.org, and get a ticket. We're hoping to not have too many walk-ins because they sort of want us to have a list of the attendees ahead of time, but we are prepared to, we'd welcome walk-ins if we have the room. So,
May 2nd, 40 Broad Street, down in Lower Manhattan?
Correct. Right.
Broad Street's part of New Amsterdam.
Yes, and speaking of New Amsterdam, one of our speakers will be Robert LaValva from the New Amsterdam Market.
Cool.
Talking about his project. And we are also, because it's an event about food, we're being very, very picky about the food. We have a great caterer, Newman's Catering, who's going to provide food throughout the day, but we're getting food donations from a number of local producers. So those will be incorporated into the menu, and we've had generous donations from Whole Foods. So this is more than just the stale bagels on a platter. We're really trying to push a very, I don't know if I could say lavish, but a very interesting menu throughout the day to just kind of highlight people who are trying to do this work, and also, as our friend Claire Harton would point out, that interesting ideas and more synopses kind of fire away over food. So we're hoping that that's true for May 2nd.
At some point, I would love to have you and Claire and Carolyn come and make the terrible schlep out to Bushwick, but sit here in the studio so that I could hear from Claire and Carolyn, whom, when I've run into them, it was too noisy to actually hear what they had to say. Claire was at the Heritage Radio event a couple of weeks ago, and I, you know, it was like I wish that I knew American Sign Language, because it was, we were having such a good time. But I know that you all have good ideas that have definite overlap with the creation of the built environment, because really you cannot separate quality of life from quality of food from quality of urban experience, which is one of the underlying premises of why we have an architecture show on the Heritage, should be Heritage Food Radio Network, actually. I mean, I'm kind of like Tony Bourdain with his food thing on the Travel Channel, only I'm not nearly as snarky as Tony yet. So do you have any, we have a few minutes left. Do you have any sort of like speculative ideas of where all of this is going to go?
Well, picking up on one of your questions earlier, you how might this play out in the built environment so that we don't have the car-based or truck-based systems? We're going to need those for a long time. But one thing that I always find very instructional is wild ecosystems, and those always happen in short distances. So going back to your composting example, feeding the local community gardens, keeping everything short distances, so then the consumers from the produce of those gardens are also local, and the more we just eliminate trucking things from state to state or across country, there are so many benefits, not just in nutritional quality, but of course carbon footprint, et cetera. Another thing about local farming systems that I'm excited about that I haven't seen really discussed too much, but it kind of escapes the grip of big ag, and because the scales are just too small, and big ag has to work at acres and acres and acres with big machines and monocultures, and the way it's going to happen in cities can't be about that. We have just little patches of spaces, and so it's necessarily going to be probably more of a polyculture, more organic, less under the grip of big industrial processes. So I think there's some very interesting opportunities there too that might we'll see thrive as in the coming years as more and more people attempt to do this and the barriers to entry get lowered.
Do you really think the big ag is going to lower any barriers to entry? I mean,
No. It's just that they're probably not going to really care about cities for a good long time because the scales are just too small. But no, of course not. Their barriers to entry are huge. I mean, but it's just a separate system altogether. So that's something I think is quite exciting to just, have some of our food come out of other systems that are not under their control.
Cool. Well, one of the benefits of the New York, greater New York City environment in terms of urban farming, unlike certain limitations in New Orleans after the Hurricane Irene, or Detroit for that matter, both of which cities have had people saying, well, let's just take all this devastated or abandoned land and get into farming, is the toxicity of soils. Irene left a lot of toxic material in the soils of the Lower Ninth Ward, which makes farming there rather sketchy, according to a conversation that we had a while back with the New Orleans-based writer, Wayne Curtis. Those of you interested can find that in the archives on iTunes. We talked about New Orleans and redevelopment. In Detroit, people have just moved out and houses crumbled, and then you end up with building debris, and we know that 19th and 20th century building materials have a lot of stuff that we wouldn't use anymore. Lead, asbestos fiber, all kinds of technological solutions to things we now find to be toxic or at least unpleasant, which is very expensive to remove from the soil.
Right. I mean, those are really important issues, and so we need to learn how to deal with that in ways that are not hugely expensive, remediating it or capping it or
right.
those kinds of things. But let's not kid ourselves. I worked on a site in Southampton that was always farmed. It had never been built on, and we tested the soil, and it came up with very, very, very high levels of lead. And so it's not just cities. It's we have a problem with soils everywhere, and not just toxic soils. The other big issue that I'm concerned about is topsoil loss, and that comes, again, back to not to, you know, demonize big agriculture too much, but these big monocultural annual crops are really, really devastating to topsoil, which takes a long time to create and very little time to destroy it if you don't use good practices.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, back in the 20th century, when I was a Boy Scout and I studied for soil and water conservation, one of the things that they taught us was the need to rotate crops.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems somehow to have been lost, and now it's chemical supplements.
Chemical pesticides. One of the reasons you do that is so you don't have this buildup of pests that favor a certain kind of crop.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A different population of different pests every year, so that it's not just swarms of locusts coming down like a plague.
Reliably.
Or the things that attack corn, which then led to Roundup, the Monsanto pesticide, which led to the GM corn seeding and all of that mess that seems somehow to be a permanent feature of American agriculture right now.
And with diminishing returns, there's more and more pesticides applied with less and less effectiveness. So that's not very, very encouraging. So another reason to just snap the backs on some of these practices.
Well, to bring it back to an architectural observation of mine, one of the theories about the decline of the Roman Empire is this notion that because of the Roman plumbing system, which was fantastic 2,500 years ago or so, but it relied on lead pipe plumbing or lead-lined aqueducts. And so there's this notion that there was just too much lead in the water, and it led to general decline in health, which led to the losing of a great amount of city-making knowledge for quite a long time. Because I'm both a bit of a foodie and also an architect, and architects have to be the generalists, worry about the decline of our knowledge base because of our exposure to these weird toxins and the pesticides that come through into the food that we eat, or even worse, unknown and unanticipated effects on our own internal DNA by eating GM foods. And, it's not just us here in the United States wondering about this. GM products are reviled in Europe, and possibly for good reason.
Although I see some debate on that, and I don't fully grasp it, but there's GMO, and then there's GMO. There's there's manipulating of plant species, and then there's extreme manipulation. And I think there's just a wide spectrum of that. And some people who I respect are actually somewhat advocating it. I don't know enough to sort of take a stand, but I don't think it's completely settled. I think the other thing is the bioaccumulation of all these different toxins and other things in our waters and in our bodies. It's not just GMO. It's like thousands of other ingredients that we're just taking into our bodies.
Well, then to circle back to the work that you're hoping to do with BioCities, to what extent can these ecological interventions, and I hate that word intervention because it just sounds so like we
grad
know
school.
Well, it's yeah, grad school, exactly, or like we know better and you poor savages who haven't studied this really don't know anything, which I find inherently arrogant and actually ignorant in its own way. Anyway, mm-hmm. These ecological interventions, to what extent can they actually work to remediate some of this toxicological buildup in our environment?
Well, I can't answer that very precisely, but we know that they can do quite a bit. I mean, plants can process waste and make them benign. I mean, certain kinds of waste, I would say not heavy metals, but there's a lot that nature just does take care of. I mean, look at what microbes do. They metabolize waste, and they do that all over the world without us even noticing. And there's just so much that happens just with these processes that we haven't really even begun to appreciate or recognize. So that's part of, I'm not trying to answer all those questions, I'm just trying to take on a piece of it and take some small steps to go in that direction.
Cool. Well, I'm really glad to have a run into this other clan of food and environment related people through Jimmy Carbone's
mm-hmm.
event
yeah.
last year. Who knew that we all knew so many people in common and were working in other, you know, related little pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
Increasingly everybody in the food and built environment worlds find themselves, I think, no more than 3 degrees of separation apart. I mean, everybody seems to know someone who knows somebody else very closely, and we're all working in our own little tribal ways on this piece of the puzzle and another piece.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to help people do the right thing in terms of good green building, but you can't do good green building without also considering the landscape or ecological aspects of that. And then we end up looking at the Manhattan Project, which informs what we might do in terms of good green building to work with the natural geology of the site instead of against it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting world we live in, and I would like to think that we're picking up the ball and doing the right progressive sort of thing that our conservation president, Mr. Roosevelt, 100 years ago, would have been encouraging us to do in his enthusiastic way. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. I've been speaking with Kate Bakewell of BioCities. This has been Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.